From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the man Eric Clapton called the best guitarist alive, Buddy Guy. We'll talk about how he developed his flashy blues guitar style, which has influenced many rock guitarists. Guy was born the son of sharecroppers in Louisiana. As a young man, he went to Chicago and became a central figure in that city's blues scene. Now his work is known around the world. Also, the rock and roll record that teenagers thought had the dirtiest lyric ever recorded. So did the FBI, which spent 2.5 years investigating the song Louie Louie. Dave Marsh spent even more time chronicling the song's bizarre saga. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the Oxford Book of Modern Fairy Tales. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon said today that U.S. troops could remain in Somalia until 1995. While the United States hopes that a quicker withdrawal is possible, the Pentagon says it's committed to the humanitarian mission in Somalia. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Navy Captain Michael Doubleday, the Pentagon spokesman, says as long as there is a U.N. commitment in Somalia, the U.S. will be part of that commitment. Pentagon officials do seem to be toning down their military rhetoric, however, and placing more emphasis on the humanitarian aspects of the mission. At the State Department, for instance, officials were linking Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid to the weekend deaths of 4 American soldiers, while at the Pentagon, Aidid was referred to as a petty warlord.
Our emphasis remains on the larger issue of feeding people, ending the violence, encouraging political reconciliation, and economic development throughout the entire country.
Doubleday also said it will be up to the UN forces in Somalia to decide on any military response to the killings of the Americans. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The leader of the Bosnian Serbs warned today that NATO airstrikes on his troops would lead to all-out war in Bosnia. Radovan Karadzic told the Associated Press that NATO bombings would bring an end to peace talks among the Serbs, Croats, and Muslims. Karadzic said he would probably lose control of the central military command in Bosnia and could no longer prevent Serbs from making revenge attacks on UN peacekeepers. Violence committed by and against children is more serious than ever, according to a report released today by the American Psychological Association. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Teenagers are 2.5 times more likely to be victims of crime than any other age group. And in some large cities, 7 out of every 10 children have seen someone shot, stabbed, robbed, or killed. What's indisputable, says Dr. Leonard Aaron, who directed the 2-year study, is that children are not born aggressive. They learn aggression.
The violent youth has learned that violence is an appropriate way to solve interpersonal problems, to vent frustrations, to get material rewards that one feels he or she deserves but has not attained.
Child abuse, discrimination, economic opportunity, and access to drugs and guns are the root causes of violence, Aaron says. These problems are so vast that schools, parents, the entertainment industry, law enforcement, and mental health experts must link their efforts and focus on conflict resolution and counseling for children who begin to lash out early on. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points today to close at 3,572. This is NPR News. The Coast Guard says today's collision of 3 vessels spilled as much as 336,000 gallons of oil into Florida's Tampa Bay. The accident also set off a smoky fire in a barge carrying 7.9 million gallons of jet fuel and other fuels. The Saturn Car Division of General Motors is recalling almost every car it's built to fix a wiring problem. The defect has caused at least 34 fires, but Saturn officials say no one's been injured. Roger Adams of member station WDET reports.
The problem is a defective connection between Saturn's generator and the generator wiring. A short circuit could heat up and cause an engine fire even when the car is not running. The voluntary recall affects more than 350,000 Saturns. General Motors is calling the action a voluntary safety campaign. Letters have gone out to Saturn owners, and the problem will be fixed free of charge. Keith Crane, publisher of the trade journal Automotive News, says the recall should have little effect on future sales.
General Motors has taken the routine precaution of recalling the cars and replacing a particular piece of the wiring circuit. I don't think the people who are interested in buying a new Saturn will be dismayed by that one bit.
But other analysts say that the recall could hurt the company's image. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Adams in Detroit.
CIA Director James Woolsey flew to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia today to recover the body of an American who was shot to death yesterday. The murdered man, 45-year-old Fred Woodruff, was listed as a State Department employee who was temporarily posted to the U.S. Embassy. Newspaper reports have hinted that Woodruff was actually a member of the CIA. U.S. officials have refused to confirm that, but the Associated Press quoted one anonymous official as saying that the CIA director's decision to claim the body speaks for itself. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rock guitar heroes like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and the late Stevie Ray Vaughan have called Buddy Guy their favorite guitarist. Buddy Guy was one of the first blues guitarists to use electronic feedback and distortion. Guy was born in rural Louisiana in 1936, the son of sharecroppers. He set out for Chicago as a young man and quickly became a central part of that city's blues scene. He has his own club there now called Legends. Recently, a box set of his sessions for the Chess record label from the 1960s was reissued. And in 1991, he recorded his first album in over 12 years. It featured Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck. His new album, Feels Like Rain, is on Silvertone Records. Guy is on the road with a blues tour that also features B.B. King. Before we meet Buddy Guy, there's a solo I want you to hear from his new album. This is a Muddy Waters song called She's 19 Years Old.
What says I'm good to you? Now don't care if you get mad. You're about to cool in the woman that I'll ever have. She's 19 years old. She got ways just like a baby child. I'm just trying to make this little woman feel satisfied.
Buddy Guy, welcome to Fresh Air. You were messing around with guitar distortion before you'd heard rock guitarists like Hendrix do it. Can I ask you how you started discovering that on your own?
Accidentally. Actually, in Chicago there, we didn't have stages. We'd always go in the corner and play. And they had jukeboxes during the breaks, and they would play tunes. And that's how I learned, by listening to other people, greats, Muddy, Walter, Wolf, and so on. And I forgot to turn my guitar off one day, and a lady passed by, and her dress tail hit the G string, and it just stayed there with an extortion for about 20 minutes. And I said, I'll never forget that. And I went up, and it worked with me, and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, explain this again. Her dress touched the G string?
Yeah, and I forgot to cut it off, and it was lying against the amplifier, you know. And as I said,
oh,
we didn't have a stage. We were just in the corner playing, and she'd get up from her table to probably go get a drink or use the bathroom or something like that. And I said, wow, I forgot to cut my guitar off. It was right in tune with the particular tune that was playing on the jukebox.
So then how did you start using that yourself intentionally?
Well, after I found out it would stay and extort that long, I just went up one day and played and stood right there where it was, and it works.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were recording for Chess Records back in the first part of the 60s, you were already doing some of this on stage, I think, but you've said that Leonard Chess didn't like that. He wouldn't let you cut loose.
Well, first of all, you know, Leonard had gotten to the point that, you know, let's, for an example, if you had went in there and say, I want to do some rapping, now they would have shot you with a shotgun, you know. But if you was in the streets, you know what the young people was asking for and what was they was reacting to the, what you was playing. And I was like throwing the guitar down, missing notes, and it was ringing out with the extortion stuff and people just going crazy saying, look at that, listen to that. And I would try to take it back and say, this is what's out there. And they would say, get out of here, you know. And I'm like saying, okay. And later on in his life, I think it was like 3, 4, 6 months before he passed away, he called me in and said, I want to talk to you. And he had found out, because that was a Hendrix, a Eric and the Cream and so on playing that. He looked at me and said, how dumb could I be? You've been trying to give me this stuff for so long. And I was calling it noise, not selling in the millions. I said, you're kidding me, you know. And it was just like a joke to me.
Well, Buddy Guy, I want to play one of your first records with Chess Recordings, and all your stuff with Chess has recently been reissued. And you were saying that Leonard Chess wouldn't let you do what you really wanted to, but this is a really pretty good recording. It's called First Time I Met the Blues. It was recorded in 1960. Little Brother Montgomery's at the piano. Do you remember this session?
Yes, that's Little Brother Montgomery tune. Him and Willie Dixon got me together on that, because I was with Cobra Records before that, and I got with Chess in the 60s, and that's the tune they brought me first. And I was more of a student, a listener, well, whatever you might say at that time, and I was doing whatever they thought was best for me in order for me to get a record out with the Chess people, because otherwise if I went in there and said, look, I'm doing it my way, I would have been, you probably wouldn't be talking to me now, because that was the company then at the time to try to get recorded with.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Recorded in 1960, my guest Buddy Guy on guitar and vocals.
The first time I met the blues, he knew that I was walking down through the woods. Yeah!
Buddy Guy, and that session's just been reissued on the Complete Chess Studio Recordings. Let me mention, too, you have a new album, which we'll be hearing from a little bit later again, and that's called Feels Like Rain. Let's go back to your very early years. Your father was a sharecropper. Did your parents want you to get off the plantation? Were you brought up with the sense of when you get old enough, you should really get out of here?
My parent was like, I got two sisters and two brothers, five of us, and they was like sharecroppers, and they would teach us all that when we got grown, if you go away, I want you to go away, do better than we did. And if you marry an elephant, if you love him, we have to like him. And that's just the way they was until they passed away. They never was the type of people that tried to choose what we should do or what not. They just told me, son, don't be the best in town. Just be the best until the best come around.
Were there any musicians on the plantation where you grew up?
Not really. It was a distant guy. My dad brought the first guitar for me from, and his mother, my grandmother. And if she was living, I was talking to you today, and you 10 minutes conversation with her, she would figure out that we was related in some kind of way or another. But sooner or later, if you think back real deep religious-wise, I guess we are in a way of speaking. But she could figure that out, and this guy was supposed to be some kind of distant relative of ours, and that's just the way they had me feeling, and I kind of feel that way now with the music I'm playing and going and traveling around the world. Everybody I see looks and smiles the same, you know. I just see you bigger, taller, smaller, different colors, but we still walking around on two legs, drinking water and eating food and sleeping and talking.
So she got this guy to give you a guitar or
no,
teach
my
you guitar?
No, my dad played $2 for it. It had two strings on it. No, first electric guitar I saw was Lightning Slim, and I gave him my weekly allowances, which is 35 cents.
Oh, you heard him playing and you...
No, he came through on a Sunday evening, plugged up on the storefront porch and played Booker Chiller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did you get your first amplifier?
A stranger bought my first real guitar and my first real amplifier. He bought it for me. Actually, I was sitting on my sister's porch with the two strings trying to get my first year in high school. My mother had a stroke, and a stranger passed and said, "Son, I bet if you had a guitar, you would learn how to play." And this is a Thursday evening. I said, "Probably so." And he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I said, "I sit here every evening." And the next evening, he came by and said, "Let's go." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I'm going by your guitar." And he went, took me downtown and bought the guitar. My sister came in, and we were laughing. They was drinking the quarter beer. And said, "Well, let's go in the country where my mom and dad at." And the country boy with a country guitar. And the guy followed us out. Then, strangely enough, him and my dad talked for 10 minutes, and they grew up together as boys.
So who was he?
The guy's name was Mitchell. He grew up as a boy with my dad. And after he bought the guitar, my dad tried to trace him down, which he moved to Chicago and became a preacher. And we never could track him down because I still owed him the money for the guitar. Still do.
So do you feel like you still owe him a lot of thanks? Do you feel like you were able to express?
A lot. And I'm sure wherever he is at this point, if there's any way that he should know I want to thank him. And I owe my whole career to him.
You left the plantation when you were 21. You went to Chicago.
No. I left the plantation trying to get to one-year high school and went into Baton Rouge.
Oh, I see.
And then I left Baton Rouge September 25th, 1957, 8:40 a.m. in the morning.
Wow, you really remember exactly the moment.
I can't forget that.
Tell me about that moment.
My mother was sick, and she had a stroke, and she kept telling me, if you don't live my life around her, because we were very close, and I figured that, you know, I should stay. And she said no, and she learned how to make us understand some of the things she was saying, because it affects your speech. And she said, "Go," you know, and I said, "Okay, if you're happy, I'm gone." And she smiled and said, "Go." And when she heard the first record I made, to tell me, she gave him a big smile.
Did you see her again after you left?
Oh, yeah. I went to see her every year until she passed away. She passed away April 16, 1968. I had been jamming with Hendrix when she passed away.
Huh.
Oh, yeah.
So you went to Chicago. Why did you choose Chicago?
I didn't go to Chicago to be a musician. I went there looking for better common labor employment, and I got there and got stranded and wound up being forced to play guitar. Because at one point in my life, I was too shy to even talk. You wouldn't get the answers you get now from me when I was about 20 years old. I can tell you that.
So were you playing on the street for money?
No. This stranger met me on the street and led me, and I played a Jim Reed song for him, and he led me to this famous club. It was the 708 Club, and that's the address, 708 East 47th Street, and that was Otis Rush on stage. And he let me, went on stage, and I played a song, and somebody went and called Muddy, and he come out, and I was telling him I was trying to get back to Louisiana because I was busted, hungry, and had an aid on going on the third day. And he come and brought the salami and the loaf of bread and say, "Don't think about going back to Louisiana."
Muddy Waters said that?
Yeah.
So what happened next? Then you started getting bookings?
No, they start coming. Yeah, well, the local clubs. It wasn't no such thing as booking and traveling. But I got to work in that club and a few more. I had 1 million clubs in Chicago that time and 2 million musicians. And you had to play the top 10 on the jukebox, and at least some of them, to get in the clubs. And fortunately, I could do that. I had to play the Ray Charles, What I Say. I had to play B.B. King. I had to play Muddy Waters. I had to play Bobby Bland. And I had the advantage of some of the guys, because some of them would just want to be Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Little Walter. And I didn't stay at that. I tried to let them all, Lightning Hopkins and everybody. And so I had a little advantage to that, because I learned how to copy all of their music.
Tell me more about what the blues scene was like in Chicago when you started playing there.
for 6.5 or 7 years, I didn't know what was the weekend. I had to go back and ask somebody when was Sunday, because we even had jam sessions start at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, and you couldn't get in the place.
Were there like blues cutting contests?
Yes, that's what it was all about. It was so many clubs still. After someone decided to hire me in a club, Junior, Otis, Freddie King, Magic Sam, and Earl Hooker, just to name a few of us, we all had gigs each night. Each club was packed. A lot of people was working at a big stockyard, the steel mill, and the shift was 11 o'clock, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. That's why the Blue Monday could work. And in order for us to get together and play, we had to all say, let's start playing at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. Then nobody have a gig at night. And that's how we got to really jam together with Muddy, Wolf, Otis, myself, Junior, and everybody else. And that's why so many people would be there in the morning, because they said, man, you go to this club with a Blue Monday, you see Muddy, you see Sonny Boy, you see Little Walter, man, what a jam.
If you're just joining us, my guest is blues guitarist and singer Buddy Guy. He's got a new album called Feels Like Rain. He's also on tour. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. The great blues guitarist and singer Buddy Guy is with us. He has a new CD called Feels Like Rain. I saw you in Buffalo at the State University there. I guess it was the late 1960s. And the way I remember it, you started off on stage, but midway through the concert, you were like down the aisles, out the door, through the other end of the student union, and I think you maybe let us all outside and then back in again. I don't remember if I've exaggerated or not over the years, but you led us pretty far on
Well, that's the same thing was happening in Chicago. I had sense enough to know I couldn't challenge Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, or some of those great giants who I was learning from, and I was just trying to get some attention to let someone know that I had something that they were always sitting in chairs. Matter of fact, the blues, B.B. King does it now. He was doing it the other night. He said, we're not tired. We're just sitting down to let you know how blues was played 42 years ago. And I was like, I saw Guitar Slam, which I mentioned earlier, and I said, well, look, they can outplay me, but they can't outdo me. So I just started jumping up, laying out on my back with the guitar under my back. And, you know, you got to do this like an exercise. You know, you raise your back up off it, and it's pick the strings. If you can find a way to put your fingers in the right place, you can play it anywhere.
Did you have to get really, really, really long guitar wires from your guitar to the amplifier in order to walk as far as you did?
Well, actually, I saw Guitar Slam with that. First of all, when I first got to Chicago, I would go to the shop to have this wire made. They wouldn't make it because they'd tell me it wasn't going to work. I said, well, give me the wire, I'll make it. And I had learned how to solder my own ends on there. And finally, one of the technicians came out and said, this guy's crazy. I don't believe this thing is coming through. And they used to examine my wife. One guitar player cut it in half one night because he figured I had somebody else behind the curtain playing.
You know, it's funny. You've gone from being, a younger person trying to establish himself and trying to figure out who he is and what makes him different from everybody else, to being now, you know, one of the blues legends that everybody wants to emulate. You've talked a lot about how you felt like you really had to like work hard and outdo everybody else, you know, to call attention to who you were. Does that still motivate the kind of show that you do? I mean, because now you're a Buddy Guy. I mean, everybody knows who you are.
Not quite everybody. You know, I'm not as well known as some people who play the guitar out there. I wish I were. You know, then maybe I wouldn't have to work so hard, but. And in another sense, maybe I don't want to be like that. It might stop me from working as hard as I do. Because if you come and see me, I want you to have 110-120% of Buddy Guy, nothing less. Because if I get to the point I start taking that from you, I don't think I want to play anymore.
Do you still have the energy to do the kind of show you used to do?
I don't know if I have as much as I had. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I feel like I was when I was 17 years old. But when I pick up my guitar, I feel like I'm 14.
Your 1991 album, Damn Right I've Got the Blues, was your first album in, I think it was 12 years?
12 and a half.
Why didn't you record for that period?
I wish I could ask you that. The record company didn't think I had anything to offer, I don't suppose, because the tragic night of Stevie Ray Vaughan's death, I was there as a guest with him and Eric, and they said, something wrong, you know, we got to take you to the studio, we have to take you ourselves, and we're going to be there to record with you. And Eric was there. Unfortunately, Stevie passed away, and he wasn't there, but he was going to be there on the session, too, and I think that helped a lot. Eric did a lot. He brought me into London for 2 years in a row at the Royal Albert Hall. I got a lot of publicity out there, and I think some record company said, well, we better check him out. Everybody's talking about how good he is. So I said, well, I better do my best on this. Damn right, I got the blues. They came in, and that's my first gold record.
So the people who you had influenced over the years, the Rockettars who you'd influenced over the years, helped you when you needed the help.
And they still do. You know, actually, and I'm trying to do the same thing now. It's just one of these things now. Record companies is not as, how should I say that, as bad as they was years ago. By this mod is, you can't go there. We playing more together now. I got a chance to do a cut with B.B. King. I did Coco Tell. I just did Junior Wells coming out. I made a range of Otis Fresh, got a new record coming out, and so on. Which, you know, on mine, there's Bonnie Raitt, there's Paul Rodgers, there's Travis Tritt, and we just like saying, hey, man, let's get together and have some fun. And mm-hmm. when they invite me over, hey, it's never too late. It's never too early. Just call me, and I'll be there.
Let me ask you about the influence of B.B. King on your playing and what the influence has been and where the point of departure is. You've known him a long time. You've been on stage with him a bunch of times.
We're on stage together now for the next 40 days.
Right, you're on tour together.
Yeah, right now, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about his influence on you and also how you feel very different from him.
Well, let me put it to you like this. His influence should be on every guitar player that picks up a guitar, because he told me when I first met him, he didn't learn how to use the slide, and we all, Eric, Stevie, myself, Albert King, Albert Collins, we all squeeze the strings. And I tell him every time I get a chance to talk with him, he's the one that invented that, squeezing the string and bending it the way we do. And on tour with him now, it's like Buddy Guy's going to school in his first year and in grade school. I'm still learning from him. And as long as he's around, I still think his name should be on every guitar that's put out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Buddy Guy, I have one last question for you. We're recording this interview.
Okay.
And we started recording this interview at 9:30 in the morning. And there are very, very few musicians who will wake up to do a 9:30 in the morning interview. You're on the road. You're in the middle of a tour. How the heck did you get up this early?
Well. Honestly, I'm still a country farm boy, and I don't want to change that. And all of my life, I don't care how late I stay up or what, I still get the sleep that I think I need. But it's just the thrill of my life. I love this as well as I do my guitar. To get up at 5:30, maybe even at 5 in the morning, and go out and take a big, deep breath of fresh air and say, I remember when I had to get up like this and go feed the hogs, chickens, and cows, and I still get the fresh air. And I got two little dogs whenever I'm at home, and I don't need an alarm clock.
Buddy Guy, thank you so much. It's really been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much, and I enjoyed every minute of it. Don't wait so long next time.
Buddy Guy, his new album is called Feels Like Rain. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If you leave me, I'll go crazy. If you quit me, I'll go crazy. 'Cause I love you, I love you. Oh, I love you too much.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the song that inspired countless teenage sex fantasies. The lyrics of Louie Louie were hard to understand, but they were supposed to be very dirty. That's why the FBI spent over 2 years investigating the song. Dave Marsh calls it the best of songs and the worst of songs. We'll talk about his new book, tracing one of rock's most enduring rumors. And once upon a time, an editor decided to hunt up fairy tales written since the mid-19th century and compile them in a book. Critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of the Oxford Book of Modern Fairy Tales. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. UN forces in Somalia have closed two airports outside the capital to prevent fugitive factional leader General Adid from buying weapons with proceeds from drugs flown into the country. Roger Hearing of the BBC has more on the story.
The airports, known as K-50 and Abu Air, are used every day by small planes bringing in the drug chat, a sort of leaf that is chewed by a huge number of Somalis, produce the effect of a mild amphetamine. The drug is legal here, and import companies can make large amounts of money by flying in the leaf from Kenya and other neighboring countries. The UN says it has identified this money as a major source of income for General Adid, and that the planes are often used to bring in weapons for him as well. Chat is an important part of life for many Somalis. It's one of the few pleasures many of the people here have open to them, and a reduced or delayed supply could lead to public anger against the UN. Whatever the real reason, many Somalis will see this action as some kind of collective punishment for the attacks on the UN by General Adid.
Roger Hearing of the BBC reporting from Somalia. U.S. officials say that four soldiers killed Sunday in Somalia were victims of a remote control bomb. Not a landmine explosion is first thought. Officials also say they believe the attack was the work of General Adid, but that it's also possible another group was behind it as well. There are now some 4,000 U.S. troops in Somalia as part of a U.N. mission, and State Department officials say for the time being, it is essential that they stay there. A federal jury in Galveston, Texas, has ruled in favor of American Airlines in a billion-dollar lawsuit filed against it by Northwest and Continental. It took the jury less than 3 hours to conclude that American had not tried to unfairly drive Northwest and Continental out of business during last summer's airfare war. Wade Goodwin reports.
The speed with which the jury returned its verdict made it clear that lawyers for Continental and Northwest never came close to proving their case. The weaker carriers had tried to prove that last summer American Airlines tried to drive them out of business by cutting airfares below cost. Continental and Northwest claimed that with them out of the way, American could then recoup their losses by raising fares on routes where they'd been competitive. American's value pricing plan, which debuted in April of 1992, set off a disastrous price war which cost the industry billions of dollars. The jury apparently believed American Airlines executives' assertion that their new fare structure was just an attempt to simplify airfares, not put the weaker carriers out of business. The antitrust case could have cost American as much as $3 billion had they lost the trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Galveston.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points to close at 3,572.73 on volume of more than 255 million shares. This is NPR News. Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been sworn in as the newest justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. After ceremonies today at the White House, Justice Ginsburg said that she would try in every way to justify President Clinton's faith in her. She also said that times are changing. And Mr. Clinton had made that clear in her appointment and the fact that so far half a dozen of his 14 nominations to the federal bench are women. The Department of Justice has asked a federal appeals court in Cincinnati to reconsider last week's decision allowing John Demjanjuk back in the country. He was acquitted recently of being the Nazi death camp guard Ivan the Terrible. Steve Hirschberg of member station WVXU reports.
The government wants all 14 members of the appeals court to review last week's ruling by a three-judge panel that Demjanjuk be allowed to enter the United States while the panel reconsiders its decision to extradite him to Israel. The Justice Department is also asking that last week's decision be stayed until the full court rules on the government's request. The appeals court panel has said Demjanjuk should be present while it determines whether the government withheld evidence that could have helped him fight his extradition to Israel. The Justice Department contends the three-judge panel lacked authority to permit the former Cleveland auto worker's return to this country. The Circuit Court of Appeals is not saying when it will decide on the government's request to rehear last week's ruling. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Hirschberg in Cincinnati.
The government said today that workers' productivity dropped again in the second quarter of the year. According to the Labor Department, from April through June, productivity fell 2.5%. for its biggest decline in more than 4 years. This followed a 1.6 drop in the first quarter of the year and was the first consecutive decline in more than 2 years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1964, teenagers around America tried to figure out the garbled lyrics on the Kingsmen's record Louie Louie. Just about everyone was sure this song was real dirty. While the lyrics inspired teen sex fantasies, the beat inspired the bass line on countless rock records. It's rock's most recorded song, covered by everyone from punk bands to middle-of-the-road instrumentalists. There have been Louie Louie radio marathons and Louie Louie parades. Now rock critic Dave Marsh has written a Louie Louie book. Tracing the history of the song, he says, tells the story of rock and roll. The song was written in 1955 by a black rhythm and blues singer and songwriter named Richard Berry, who recorded it in 56. Dave Marsh told me how the rumors got started years later that the Kingsmen were singing dirty lyrics.
A bunch of fraternity boys decided in 1963 when the Kingsmen, this high school band from Portland, Oregon, had decided to record the record, which was a sensation, and that song was a sensation in the Pacific Northwest. And when their record came out, for unknown reasons to anybody, I guess some college kids as a fraternity prank told the governor of Indiana that the song had dirty words. And a rumor like a urban legend went around high schools and junior highs all across America that if you played the 45 of the Kingsmen at 33 1/3 RPM, you would hear dirty words about sex. And so the governor of Indiana immediately banned it in the state of Indiana. And I mean, he says he didn't, but he did. He called the Broadcasters Association and told them that if it was dirty, they should get it off the air, and if they couldn't prove it, they should think twice. So not being able to prove it, they got rid of it. And then the FBI got their hooks into it, and they kept their hooks into it until the middle of 1966 when they started going after the Beatles or something. I don't know why they gave up.
What would the song have been violating if the lyrics were dirty?
Oh, several laws. Primarily a law called the Interstate Transportation of Obscene Materials Law. The FBI, when they talked to Richard Berry in 1965, told him he was going to jail. Flat out. They said, Richard, you're going to go to jail. And Richard said, for what? And they said, well, you wrote a dirty song. He said, no, here's the sheet music. And the sheet music contains a story which, in fact, is what Richard sang and what the Kingsmen sang and what everybody pretty much sings, which is a story of a Jamaican sailor sitting at a bar, pouring his heart out to a bartender named Louie, saying, Louie, Louie, me gotta go back to Jamaica to see this fine little girl who's waiting for me. And that's it. But the FBI could not be persuaded of this, at least for the first 2.5 years. They finally concluded that it was unintelligible at any speed.
What did the FBI do to try to make out the lyrics?
Oh, well, all we have left are lab reports. The lab reports basically say, you know, record was sampled on such and such a date, sent in from Tampa or sent in from San Diego or sent in from Detroit or sent in from Indianapolis. They got samples from all these different cities like they were selling different records in different places. I don't know. Anyway, and then it'd say, well, we were unable to determine what the words are. But I presume what they did was they took it and with their excellent, no doubt, stereo equipment of the day, attempted to play the record slow and discern dirty words. Because if they could have found dirty words, it's illegal to ship such stuff, or at least it was then, across state lines. It was illegal to play it on the radio.
Did the FBI come up with dirty lyrics?
What they came up with were lyrics that were confiscated from children by high school principals and junior high school principals. And so they have a Tampa version, a San Diego version, and a Detroit version. And for those of you still in the habit of going to your local library and looking books up, they're on for the good parts. They're on a page 120 and 121 of my book. Are the purported dirty lyrics, some of which do not scan, none of which make any anatomical sense, but all of which indeed are about people having sex instead of a Jamaican sailor trying to wend his way home.
Rec critic Dave Marsh is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Marsh, author of the new book, Louie Louie. Let's run through some of the versions of Louie Louie and do a little capsule history. Why don't we start with Richard Berry's recording, recorded in 1956?
In 1957. As a matter of fact, you're playing that from the Rhino Anthology, right?
Yeah.
Now, that is not the original version, but it's so close to the original version that you practically need a meter to tell it. And Max Firetag, who's the guy who owns the original version, was mad at Richard and refused to license it to Rhino. So Richard Foos at Rhino simply took Richard and some other singers in and did an exact duplicate of the record. And it was so close that Firetag called up and said, I'm going to sue you. I told you you couldn't use that.
So these are all like dummy singers? These people are not Richard Berry?
Well, Richard Berry is Richard Berry, but the other people who are with him are not the people who are on the original record, nor was the record cut in 1957. It was cut about 1980 or 81.
So what's the lyric that he used?
He used the standard, a fine little girl, she's waiting for me. I catch a ship across the sea. I sail that ship all alone. I never think I make it home. Louie, Louie, me gotta go. That's Richard's version. That's what everybody sings pretty much.
Now, after he wrote this song, his version never became a hit. And he actually sold his copyright for, $750?
In 58, a year later, Richard decided he wanted to get married to Dorothy Berry, as she became, who became one of Ray Charles' Ray Letts. And he wanted to buy her a nice wedding ring and have a nice wedding and everything. So he sold this song and about six others to Max Firetag, who owned the record company, Flip Records, for $750. And for the next 25 years, that was all the money that Richard saw from that song, was $750. He would get occasional little bitty airplay checks from BMI, but I'm sure he never saw $20,000 from the song in the 25 years.
How did he get his rights back?
By hook and by crook. If Richard had died, his family would have been able to go in after 25 years and say, this copyright is this term of the copyright is expiring, and to renew it, we're going to renew it ourselves, and we're not going to let you keep the rights. But Richard lived. And so what they had to do was California Coolers, a wine cooler company, wanted to use the song in an advertisement. And Richard had a claim in on the song. And they said, basically, either you have to settle this potential litigation or we'll go use Wooly Bully or Wild Thing or something. So in order to get Richard out of their hair, they gave him half of the song back, which he retains to this day. Richard went at that point from living on welfare to living, you know, a pretty decent lifestyle, and he has a decent car and a decent place to live now. But it was really a radical change when he got it back. It was like a miracle.
Okay, let's hear the Richard Berry recording of Louie Louie.
Louie Louie, we gotta go. Louie Louie, we gotta go. Sail the ship all alone. I never think I make it home. And Louie Louie, well, we gotta go. Louie Louie.
That sounds kind of doo-wop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, moving along here, after he records it, nothing happens, right? played on some West Coast stations?
There's a guy up in Seattle named Ron Holden who had a big record with I Love You So, who picks it up and this dance that's around the Chalypso. He uses it in battles of the bands because the kids would get up and dance the Chalypso and he would win the battle of the bands if he played Louie Louie. And so from him, all these... There was an amazing rock scene in Seattle at the time. And one of the neat things about doing the book is I sort of got to do the background for everybody's Nirvana and Pearl Jam book to come later. But the bands called the Wailers, the Frantics, the Sonics, all these wildcat bands that were up there, kind of the dinosaurs of grunge, I think of them as, they all did Louie Louie. Louie Louie became the anthem of the Pacific Northwest. And they played this place called the Haunted Castle, which was this which actually Jimi Hendrix's song, because Jimmy was from Seattle, Spanish Castle Magic is about what went on in that place. And mainly what went on in that place was versions of Louie Louie, taken to the nth degree of just craziness. And that was where the song got speeded up, and that was where this guy from the Wailers named Rockin' Robin Roberts added the immortal line to the middle, let's give it to him right now, in a shriek.
Well, baby, you gotta go.
After the Wailers recorded Louie Louie, two bands started playing it a lot, the Kingsmen and Paul Revere and the Raiders. Paul Revere later had the hits Kicks, Hungry, Good Thing. Why do you think the Kingsmen version caught on and the Paul Revere and the Raiders version did not?
Literally, it caught on because nobody would ever have played the Paul Revere and the Raiders version on their radio show as the worst record of the week. And a guy named Arnie Woo Woo Ginsburg in Boston, who was the biggest disc jockey in Boston at the time, played it twice on his show one night in 63 as the worst record of the week. And the next day when he got in to work, there were 50 phone calls, where can I buy this record? And that's how Louie Louie became a hit. It had flopped out west. The Raiders were far bigger in Seattle. They were far bigger in San Francisco, and they were at least as big in Los Angeles with the same song. But the Kingsmen record had this myth, and then the rumor kicked in about the dirty lyrics, and it was all over. And you can watch it. You can trace its path up the chart week by week as they're neck and neck for a while. The Raiders are a little ahead, and the Raiders are on Columbia Records, the biggest record company in North America. The Kingsmen were on Wand, which was a subdivision of Scepter, which was a little tiny record label run out of where Studio 54 was later, whose biggest act was the Shirelles. And yet, when this rumor kicked in, and after Arnie Ginsburg played it as the worst record of the week twice, they took off like a rocket and went totally past anything that Columbia Records imagined for the Raiders.
There have been dozens and dozens of cover recordings of these, some of them just incredibly ludicrous. Why in the world would Pete Fountain do a middle-of-the-road cover of Louie Louie? I mean, What was his producer thinking? Why bother?
Well, first of all, you got to remember, Louie Louie was one of the 10 or 12 biggest records of 1963. And in 1963 and 64, if you were making a middle-of-the-road record, they gave you a checklist. Here were the big records last year. Do them. And Louie Louie would work as an instrumental. Louie Louie, in terms of just being three chords of music, is okay. You know, you can play it on clarinet. Why someone decided Julie London had to sing it, now that's an interesting question. And then after that, it became a standard. It became part of the rock and roll repertoire. And so Tina Turner sort of needed a version to put into her club show. And so she did this wonderful version in which she makes Louie a guy and says to him, basically, you think you're getting me without a yacht? Forget about your little ship. You sail all alone. I want a yacht, or get out of here. Which is probably my favorite lyrical change that anybody ever made in a straight version of the song, anyway.
You can go for Tina Turner. I'm going to play the Pete Fountain version. Let's go out with what might be the latest Louie Louie recording by Iggy Pop. He's got it on his new album.
Well, it's one of my favorite versions that anybody ever did, and not only because Iggy's an old friend who did the only version I've ever heard on a record called Metallic KO of the dirtiest version of the Dirty Words, but also because what he essentially does on his record is what I try to do in the book, which is show why Louie Louie really does symbolize the end of civilization. He basically is talking about how he looks at CNN, he looks at this and that, finds himself appalled by the world, and his response is, it makes me want to sing Louie Louie.
And Gorbachev, the wall is down, but something is lost. Turn on the news, it looks like a movie. It makes me want to sing
Iggy Pop from his forthcoming album, American Caesar. Dave Marsh's new book is called Louie Louie. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the developments in the story of the apparent suicide of Vincent Foster, the former White House attorney?
Hi, Terry. Neil Totenberg reports on the content of a note written by Vincent Foster. The FBI is not calling this a suicide note, but it does indicate that Foster was indeed depressed and disturbed about the firing of White House travel office employees. In other stories, Cheryl Duvall has a story about people who have been profiting from the flooding along the Mississippi River Valley. Ted Clark tells us about the latest State Department thinking on Somalia. Patricia Naiman goes back to Cleveland to check on health care expectations with some folks there she's talked with before. Also, David Isay visiting a few old favorite bars in Milwaukee.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Maureen Carrigan took the Oxford Book of Modern Fairy Tales along on her vacation. She says the combination of reading and recreation was a recipe for danger.
Once upon a time, two people traveled deep into the woods in search of something rare called a vacation. They came upon a palatial hotel, and when they asked the ritual question, "Do you take American Express?" the hotel doors flew open. Every day, the two people swam in a silver lake and ate meals prepared by unseen hands. Every night, they fell into a giant feather bed and slept as if bewitched. When the time came for them to return to something nasty called work, they whined and wailed and decided not to. so they stocked up on potato chips and barricaded themselves in their room. And the kindly hotel manager was so moved by the vacationers' desire to dwell there, free of charge, that he left them alone. And there they live, happily ever after. For a few days last week, I believed this Midsummer Night's Dream of mine might just come true. That's the risk of reading fairy tales on a vacation. You're in such an unreal state of mind anyway. Fairy tales can push you over the edge. And believe me, the stories in the Oxford Book of Modern Fairy Tales are every bit as potent as their classic counterparts. Editor Alison Lurie has gathered together 40 fairy tales written during the last century and a half by British and American writers. They're a distinguished crew, everybody from Charles Dickens to James Thurber to Ursula Le Guin. But this collection also introduced me to lesser-known writers, some of whose biographies are as fantastic as their fairy tales, like, for instance, Frances Brown. She was born in poverty in 1816, one of 12 children. Although she was blind, Brown somehow got an education and supported herself by writing children's stories. Her tale, The Story of Fairyfoot, is a comic confection about the people of Stumpingham, who equate beauty with big feet. Some of the Victorian tales here are a tad preachy, and some of the contemporary ones a bit too ironic. I like my fairy tales unfractured, weird, disturbing. So reading Lucy Lane Clifford's The New Mother gave me shivers of delight. It's an eerie tale about two children whose bad behavior drives their mother away. A new mother takes her place, a mother with a wooden tail and glass eyes. Rumor has it that Clifford's friend, Henry James, borrowed from the story for his own chiller, The Turn of the Screw. I also like how Angela Carter restores an element of repulsion to Beauty and the Beast. Here's how Carter's Beast, renamed Mr. Lion, bids Beauty goodnight. Mr. Lion flung himself at Beauty's feet and buried his head in her lap. She felt his hot breath on her fingers, the stiff bristles of his muzzle grazing her skin, the rough lapping of his tongue, and then understood. All he was doing was kissing her hands. I should hope so. Fairy tales express their danger and sexuality through half-suggestions, gaps in logic, smoke and mirrors. If you can't be in an enchanted place this summer, these fairy tales offer the next best thing. They keep you in a state of enchantment.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed the Oxford Book of Modern Fairy Tales. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Native American writer Jim Northrup. After fighting in Vietnam, he decided to return to the reservation where he was born in northern Minnesota and live a traditional Chippewa life. Also, we talk with jazz musician Paquito de Rivera. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.